Meet Alan, a strong advocate for mental health. He's not just someone who talks about it. He's actually been in over 1,000 stages sharing his own journey. Alan has also taught mental health classes at different colleges, has been a counselor helping others in their journey to recovery, and he's a best-selling author with 3 books as part of college curriculum. Today, we engage in a meaningful dialogue on the crucial topic of men's mental health. We'll discuss the specific challenges men encounter, strategies to overcome communication barriers, and practical advice for fostering supportive environments. This conversation aims to provide valuable insight into redefining masculinity, promoting vulnerability, and instigating positive change in men's mental health. Join us today for a professional yet accessible discussion seeking to illuminate critical issues and inspired actionable steps. Hi, welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Space. Today we have Alan Keller with us. Alan, how are you?
I'm the dream, they say. Good to see you, Michelle.
Good to see you too. Thank you for taking the time and being with us today.
Happy to be here.
So let's cut to the chase. You were here because you have a powerful journey story for us. You're also a mental health advocate. You've done a couple of public speaking events and you just do a lot. So let's start from the beginning. Let's talk about your personal journey in mental health.
Yeah. And, you know, first of all, I would say this. Nobody chooses to struggle with mental illness. Nobody chooses to be an addict. And I don't know that as a kid, anybody chooses to be a motivational speaker. So it has been a definite journey. But for me, Michelle, I grew up small town, like I mean small, 4.5 roads. And at that time, nobody talked about mental health. My challenges really started in grade 8 with body image. I had a really hard time with physical appearance. And for me, basically the world was just my stage, because on the outside, I was the guy who was president of the school, athlete of the year, captain of sports teams, national scholarship recipient. But, you know, on the inside, there was just so much pain. The problem for me is I had no idea how to talk about that pain. And because I didn't talk about my pain, I'm the one who suffered. So for me, I just hid behind that smile. And just because someone is smiling does not mean that they are happy. That theme basically just played itself forward for a lot of years. And my challenge, Michelle, was really around being vulnerable, you know, asking for help. I had never seen someone around me talk about mental health. I'd never seen them demonstrate being vulnerable. And when I was finally able to get some formal help, and I mean, Michelle, I've seen almost 30 different mental health professionals, but in a span of 6 years, I was put on a combination of 12 different pharmaceutical pills. That's a lot of pills. And it didn't help that I was an alcoholic, a compulsive gambler, struggled with self-harm, suicidal ideations. And, you know, you get to a point eventually where you realize, if you want something different, you have to do something different. And for me, Michelle, one of those moments was when I was teaching. You know, somehow I'm functioning while having seizures almost daily. And I had ended up...
So you were a teacher?
Yeah, I was a teacher. And I was on a field placement as a student. And I had just finished teaching this one class. And I remember walking out of the classroom and my body just said, "We're out. We're not doing this anymore." And I collapsed on the hallway floor. And I bet half of my students ran out. And I remember them peering over me and they're like, "Mr. Gay, are you okay?"
Probably freaked out.
Yeah. And how do I respond? It's like, "Oh, yeah, no, you know, I'm good." Because that's what I always did. But I wasn't good. And I learned in that moment that when I am able to find my voice, I will step into my power. And I started to get myself into different spaces where people shared similar lived experiences. That was the turning point.
No, I mean, I'm sure your journey was very to the extent, and I know you had multiple diagnoses. At what point did you recognize that something was off or something wasn't really right with you?
I would say grade 8. What they had us do for the...
Oh, so you knew, okay.
Yeah, because because my thoughts were so different than anyone else's. And any time that I decided to share some of those thoughts, I realized, based on other people's observations, that it wasn't okay to talk about some of this stuff.
What made you think it wasn't okay? Like, what would they say to make you think that it wasn't okay?
Right here, here's a prime example. So grade 9 English class, we are asked to just write a poem. Just write a poem on anything. And I wrote a poem, but it was dark. You know, it was heavy. It was emotionally charged. And I remember all my peers standing up at the front and they're talking about their dog. They're talking about sports, you know, light stuff. And I get up there and I tell you, you know, the reaction was, it was just one of like, what the hell did we just listen to? And yeah, there was no applause. There was some concern. And that was one of those moments where I realized, I'm just going to keep this in.
Now, when you express those concerns, and this just out of curiosity, what about the school staff? Were you brought to, like, was there a counselor back in the day? Like, how did that manage this?
Nah, it wasn't managed at all, Michelle. I reverted right back to excelling in academics and athletics, and that's what I decided the world would see. But as you know, you can only suppress so much before one is going to become full and there's going to be unique challenges, and it's inevitable that there will be some of those telltale signs. The game changer for me was actually a professor when I was at the University of Alberta as a student, and he picked up on the fact that I wasn't doing well, and he saw a young man who's in pain, and he took the time to listen, not fix.
May I ask, what were the symptoms that you were presenting? What are the things that your teacher noticed?
You know, I'm in a class with probably 350 other students. I've talked to this professor maybe a handful of times. And after his one lecture, he walked right up to me. I don't know what he saw, Michelle. Maybe he was just intuitive. I honestly don't know how to answer that. And I've presented at a good 100 educator conferences, and that's often what people ask. What did Ian see? His name was Ian McNeil. I don't know, but he approached me and he said to me, come to my office, Al. Let's talk. And I was like, okay. For whatever reason, on that day, I accepted the invite. And I do remember later that afternoon walking up to the third floor. I walk past his office. His door's open. So I thought, okay. I walk in, and here's what's different. Ian says, have a seat, Al. And then he leans forward and he says, how are you doing today, Alan? And right there, Michelle, that's different. That's different from the robotic, how are you doing? Which is, to me, just a greeting. It's different when you add the person's name, and it's different when you use the word today. But I don't know what the numbers are. What is it, like 7% of the way that we communicate is verbal? The other 93% is what?
Yeah, our body, our image, the way we present ourselves. So you can say you're okay, but, you know, you're slouching.
And everything about Ian
McNeil. Maybe you thought you were smiling, but...
Yeah. And everything about Ian McNeil in that moment screamed compassion. There is no judgment. Michelle, that was actually the first time that I actually took off that mask. And I said, okay, Ian, you want to know? And I talked. I talked openly about my challenges. And he basically understood that we all want power. We all want to be in a position of control. And he spun it back at me and he said, what are you going to do about it? And I was like, that's interesting. He didn't leave me high and dry, though. He gave me resources. And I decided to access those resources. I started to write exams in rooms by myself. I got note takers, I got tutors, and that was so embarrassing because I was the guy who was in the top 5% of academic achievement at the university, but things had deteriorated quite rapidly. So that was one of those moments where his intervention truly put me on a different course, and he repeatedly checked in to support me.
From then on, what kind of treatment did you look out for? Did you seek therapy, or just like at what point you intervene on your mental health more than academics?
Probably 10 years. I was seeing so many different mental health professionals. I didn't know if I was coming or going. I did get to a place where I realized this Western approach does not work. The pharmaceutical pills I mean, for me, medication 100% has its place. But there's always so many side effects as well. And I got to a place where I realized I have to try something different. And for me, I started to explore alternative therapies. You know, things like Reiki became a game changer. Cognitive behavioral therapy is great. Putting a voice to our pain is great. But there are other ways that we can be free from some of those emotions and thoughts other than the traditional talk therapy.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your experience while taking the medication? I mean, I know it's not one size fits all, and I've done multiple interviews and I've heard from, like, you know, I finally found the cocktail that works for me and I'm doing great with it. And then I interview some others and they're like, no, I couldn't do medicine. So I like to ask, what was your personal experience like? Obviously not good. But what were the symptoms that you were getting that were not good for you, or what about it was it that made you stop completely?
Well, first of all, I would say it doesn't help when one is an alcoholic trying to take medication, right? So that was on me. I mean, my lifestyle was one of complete self-destruction, so pretty sure I didn't take the medication as was prescribed. You know, I take ownership over a lot of that. But the side effects varied. When one is put on 12 different pills in 6 years, I mean, I was a zombie. I had such a hard time functioning. And eventually, yeah, I just packed it in. Even that first time, the very first time that I was able to meet with a doctor, he went through this really quick checklist with me, didn't make eye contact. I didn't feel like a person. And then I walked out with a piece of paper for a prescription, which I had no clue what I was even taking. And I didn't know that you weren't supposed to stop cold turkey. You know, back then, this is 20 plus years ago, there was no formal education. And I guess I just trusted, but I also didn't do my due diligence in my own education. That's the one thing that's changed. You know, I think that we're becoming much more aware of what it is that we put into our system and trying to be part of the solution rather than just listening to an expert.
How did you get to where you are? Like, what made you want to be a mental health advocate? And what coping skills are you using now, or what treatments are? Well, I'm assuming you're still doing Reiki.
Oh, yeah.
Which I love.
You know, so for me, there was the pivotal moment was when I met a woman. Her name was Tanya, and she had two boys. And I had never really been around kids before. And when I met them, they loved me for me. I felt like I didn't have to wear some front. And it was about a year and a half after meeting them, because they lived in Saskatoon. I was living in Edmonton, which is about, you know, 300 miles away. I made the decision to move from Edmonton to Saskatoon in with my new family. And I was only 3 months sober. So I didn't have a lot to offer. You know, I move in with a lemon of a car, a bunch of student loans, no job. But sometimes we need people to believe in us more than we believe in ourselves. Yes. And yes. That was one of those moments where she said, you know, Tanya, who's now my wife, she said, we're going to move forward. If you choose to go back to these old behaviors, everything that we have around us right now, or that you have, will be gone. And it was the tough love approach, which I needed. But that was where I learned what healthy relationships looked like. That's where I learned how to really communicate effectively about what it was that I was going through. And that's where I had a partner who really pushed me to do what I was passionate about, which was putting a voice to my own story while offering strategies. And that has just taken off since then.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love it. Tell us a little bit more about that. What are your projects right now? What are you working on? And how does it feel to be a mental health advocate of your own story?
I spent most of my life trying to harm or kill myself. And there is no logical reason, none, why I should still be alive after the life that I've led, other than I feel like I've just been spared to carry a message. And I do so with such gratitude. You know, this for me is redemption. I lost my best friend to suicide. We had the same lifestyle, both struggle with mental illness, both struggle with addictions. He's gone and I'm here. And his name is Justin Andres, is the driving force behind so much of what I do. I mean, it's been 15 years now that I've been speaking, mm-hmm. and I do not take it lightly. I think that while there are a lot of great resources around mental health, the greatest resource will always be you. You know, like your story matters. And the more that we can share our lived experiences, the more connected we can become. Because when I started sharing my story for the first time, I started to hear those two powerful words from people. Me too. I was like, what? That right there was liberation, knowing that other people went through some of those challenges.
So what kind of feedback do you get when you do your public speaking? You're telling people support you and they say they're not alone. What is your hopes? What are your goals?
My goal is simply to empower people to use their voice. I know what it feels like to have lost my voice, and I know what it feels like to have found it.
You at what point were an addiction counselor, correct?
Yep.
And you got to work with that population. How did that feel after overcoming your own addiction?
Okay, so this is the twisted part. I was just over 3 months sober, Michelle, when I got hired to be an addictions counselor. Nobody knew that I was only 3 months sober. So I actually learned how to be sober by being a counselor. I don't recommend that approach. And the other thing that is interesting is...
I was going to say that's very risky of you.
Well, I don't know. It just spoke to the life that I led back then, right? It was the facade. The other interesting thing is... I was teaching at a college. I was teaching people how to become addiction counselors. And that was the same course that I was a student in a year ago that I'm now teaching. So that's bizarre. But through those two, plus going to my own 12-step meetings, that's really how I was able to learn a lot of those skills, coping mechanisms, strategies to help with my own wellness.
You were 3 months sober and you were teaching these courses. And then at what point did you decide to stop all of that to just become, are you still doing any of the teachings or counseling or just doing the mental health advocacy?
4 years ago, I made the jump to do speaking full time. So now I'm doing about 75 events annually and it's coast to coast, now getting into the States as well. So that's it. And I also do some coaching on the side, but no more instructing at colleges or formal counseling.
When you think back, well, you said nobody noticed because you're wearing a facade, you're always smiling, athlete, all this. Did you feel supported by your family? Like, how important do you think that being supported by family, friends, or having a support system is when you're going through mental health difficulty?
It's everything. And I was fortunate to have parents who are incredibly supportive. And in fact, no different than it is for a lot of guys. It's often one's mother or partner that encourages them to get help for that first time. And it was my mom. And without that support, I'm not sure that I ever would have walked into a door for the first time to get some help.
How did your mom support you?
I think that she understood that nobody wants to be fixed. I think that she understood that we just need to be heard. And she would just throw different things out there. But more importantly, I knew that that door was always open. And I think that that's the main thing, that we can show people that we're genuinely concerned. We, first of all, have to understand that silence is not the answer. Because even for me, when I was in high school and I went to a private school, all the signs were there. All the signs, but not one teacher approached me. And what's that message that we get when we're in pain and nobody approaches us?
Yeah.
Nobody cares. And I knew that they cared, but they didn't know what to say and they didn't know what to do. And you know what's interesting, Michelle? Even with all the education that's taking place, still there are a lot of people who struggle with exactly what to say when they feel like somebody might be struggling.
I think we're making some kind of progress, though. You know, I used to do school counseling and I see there's more trainings, or there's a training called mental health first aid. And they are trying to get the teachers to recognize some of the signs and not be so scared to reach out. But I did get that, you know, you have the teachers that see the signs and they talk to the student. And then you have the teachers that would just bring me the student, you know, which is totally fine. Because at the end of the day, teachers are not really trained to talk about suicide ideation. Some may freaked out, you know, they don't want to be responsible. So it goes on the counselor. It's fine. But I do believe there's a little movement there, at least here, Florida, the school systems or Miami-Dade, in order to avoid something like what happened to you, you know, to avoid those kind of situations, like something that happened to you. So I'm hopeful that in the future, staff, the whole staff in the school will be better trained to deal with these kind of things. But I think it's very important to recognize the signs. Sometimes it's hard, you know, like you said, if the grades are good and you're smiling in the hallways and you have friends, it's really hard for someone to, especially the counselor, you know, like we don't see the kids every day. So the teacher's the one you see, as a teacher, you see that student every day. So it's so important to really be the advocate for them and to kind of like, if you see a little sign, just bring it up, even if you don't want to deal with it. So I completely agree with you. But it can always be, there's always room for improvement, right?
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I would say 100% we're moving the right way. 100%. It's night and day from what it was when I was in school. And that's a positive. I would also say this. I think that I could say 10 different signs what to look for if someone's struggling with their mental health. For me, the number one is always intuition, guts, because we all have it. What I'm saying is that if you think that there's a problem, there probably is, but denial is a more comfortable place to be for a lot of people.
I think a combination of your gut and some signs would be ideal. But no, I completely agree with you in regards to the intuition. So now that, did you receive or were you able to get any resources or help in the university level? Because I know that's a whole other monster. You know, you can get all you want in high school, get your IEPs, 504s, whatever. And then you get to college and nobody knows where the counselor is, or there's a therapist. Were you able to get any kind of help in the university back in the day?
Yeah, I was really fortunate. And that goes back to the professor, Ian McNeil, who introduced me to student support services. And that was a time where I had to really swallow my pride, because I had to accept that I had a disability, and that's how they classified it. You know, when I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, OCD, that list went on and on and on. With the ADD, I realized I can't focus, I can't function in classroom settings anymore. And I was able to access student support services, and they also connected me with a counselor who I could meet with. And that was absolutely essential.
Do you think that part of why you hesitated to share your story or your emotions or how you were really feeling was because you were men? Like, do you think there's a difference between female and men when it comes to mental health?
100%. For me, it goes back to my childhood. There wasn't a single man who I saw model emotions of sadness. It was all those old scripts, right? That if you cry, if you show that emotion, you're weak. And so I, like many, just suppressed all of those emotions. I, like many men, turned to anger. But beneath anger is often sadness. And for me, you know, it's like you even talk about road rage. I was the guy who would get into my car, follow people to their house, and wait for them to get out of their car. That's not healthy. I've done a lot of work.
Wow. That's, yes.
Yeah, that's not healthy.
That I was going to say, I'm like, does that still happen?
No.
That's a lot of road rage.
No, thankfully, I'm a different person. But I'm a different person because more and more men are stepping up and saying, hey, these are some of the things that I've gone through. And I would argue that vulnerability breeds vulnerability.
I mean, I think now we keep talking more and more about it. I feel like some men are now openly talking more and more about their mental health because it's being more accepted in society. So hopefully, you know, it'll come a day where I think there's such a big difference when, like, the Gen Zs and the millennials. And I think right now we're, like, in the middle of everything, right? So, like, older crowd is raising the small generation, but, like, small generation knows about mental health now, so they're trying to teach the older generation. So I think right now there's an imbalance, but I feel like in the future it'll be more openly discussed, you know, hopefully.
I see that 100%. I was doing, I was speaking at a mining event last week, and then the week before I was in three different high schools, and you talk about the difference, like, it's palpable, and that's a beautiful thing. The last book that I wrote was on men and mental health, and I interviewed a lot of people. And what I found interesting mm-hmm. is that the vast majority of men said that what they thought was going to happen when they reached out for help did not happen. Meaning, when they were able to reach out to a person of trust, they were not met with judgment, but rather compassion. And every single person, every single man said that when they were finally able to talk about their pain, they felt free, liberated, like they no longer had to hide behind that proverbial mask. And it's as simple as they were able to get some of that darkness out, because darkness cannot survive in light. And that's my definition of healing right there. The more that we can be free from our darkness, the more room there will be for light.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And so when you go to these schools, you notice the big difference on the generations or the female and male perspective?
I see a lot, well, definitely with the generation, but even the young men. And here's an example. So I'm often called to go to schools after there's been a suicide. And I was called to this one high school after they'd lost a 15-year-old young man. And when I'm done doing a presentation, I always ask for a separate room where students can come and just talk, because it's easier to talk to someone who they don't really know. And repeatedly, I am so surprised and intrigued by how many young men are willing to be vulnerable, walk into the room and just talk. I did not see that happening 5-10 years ago.
I would see it a lot in my office too. And you know, not just the heavy stuff like suicide and depression, but small things too. Like, they would come and talk to me about girlfriend issues. It'll be like, okay, this is a first.
Santa.
It's usually the girls coming to me, you know? So I definitely do see the difference now in school, even compared to when I went to school. Counseling was not even discussed, and or counselors were only like academic, you know, or if you got in trouble. But I don't remember seeing my counselor or any of my friends going to see the counselor unless it was to do scheduling. Mm. So I think the dynamic and the perspective has switched a lot in this couple of years for the good. How do you approach mental health in your family now?
Well, I think you already answered that one through the question, talk. That's exactly it. We talk. When I was young, we did not talk. And so the difference is that our kids can say, hey, dad or mom, you know, I'm feeling a little overwhelmed today. I'm feeling a little anxious. What's different is we mm-hmm. can now say, well, what are you going to do about it? Because we've given the strategies, we've given the skills, and we can support them, but we empower them to then utilize those strategies. And then we speak openly. We access resources if need be. It's a completely different age, different time. One thing that I found interesting is we're shooting a new speaker demo reel 2 weeks ago. And there's this one scene where I'm walking through the alley after my son. And my son is in grade 8, which was the same age where my challenges with mental illness began. And for me, it was one of those full circle moments where, I mean, that's probably my greatest motivation. I will not have my sons go through the same challenges that I went through.
My son is in eighth grade too. So when you mention that, of course, in my head, I'm like, I feel like middle school is that phase where they're like really discovering themselves and seeing what they want, what they don't like, or body image issues or whatever it may be. You know, they start questioning themselves. So I think it's very important to keep an open communication. Like, mean, I talk to my son too. And like, he knows what I do too. So I'm always, you know, the word suicide or the word depression is not like, oh my God, it's just, it's like talked about. And I always tell him, if you have a friend that talks about this, feels sad or whatever, if you can't handle it, take him to the counselor or talk to someone, you know, like, don't let a kid just be like a loner. I don't know if he does it or not. He listens, and, but I'm definitely talking about it. Kids can be mean sometimes, you know?
Yes.
And it's easier to say this when you're an adult, but I think when you look back, you're like, okay, I could have been very mean.
Yes, agreed.
You forget what you were as a child. Yeah. What are some of, I mean, you go around and you do a lot of public speaking. What are some of the, the best stories that you can share, like what was a story of a person that you might have helped or that came back to you and appreciated your speech and why?
Yeah, there's two things. You know, first of all, I'll just address some of the barriers that I still see, especially with men, but ultimately how we can then smash through them. Because here's a prime example. I was delivering a talk on the power of vulnerability and just encouraging people to find their voice. And I remember there is a man who's probably mid-60s who approached me after at the front, and he shook my hand, but he didn't shake my hand as though, good job, Al. He shook my hand as though, now you listen to me. And he shared how when he was struggling with his mental health challenges at an early age, he talked to his dad, and his dad said, what the hell are you talking to me for? Fix it yourself. And so he tried. Years later, he approached his pastor, and the pastor said the same thing. What are you telling me for? Fix it. And so this guy, well, he's still shaking my hand, says, don't you dare stand up at the front of the room telling me that it's okay to ask for help, because when I did, it got slammed in my face. And I thought, wow, you know, that speaks.
Wow. Yeah, that is very powerful.
Yeah, it speaks to what still exists. But on the other hand, Michelle, I can't tell you how many men, especially men, approach me after, and it'll start something like this. There was a man not too long ago. He said, you know, I drink too much. I think I'm an alcoholic. My wife doesn't even know, but after listening to you, I'm going to ask for help. And it's one of those things where you realize the power of story. And that goes for anybody. If anybody can just speak openly about some of their challenges, it paves that way to give other people permission to see that it's okay to do so and that a better life exists. Because without hope, it is a dark, dark place.
Very powerful words from, and complete two different perspectives, right? Like the older one who did try to reach out and got rejected, and then others who are getting the help. Do you think that talk therapy is actually effective for men?
I think it certainly can be. I'm always a firm believer that you throw everything at the wall and you see what sticks. An open mind is powerful and necessary on our journey towards wellness. We don't know unless we try. There are a lot of men who find talk therapy incredibly valuable, but there's some who don't, and that's fine. But then don't stop there. Try writing. For me, pen and paper was my greatest outlet, because you can tell a piece of paper anything, and when you're done, you can rip it up, burn it, bury it, yeah, put in a balloon. The whole premise is to make sure that you're getting what's on the inside out in a healthier way. So whether it's culture, beating, sweat lodge, turning towards mindfulness, art, sports, whatever, those emotions just have to be free.
Yeah, no, I believe and agree with an integration of different methods, not just a talk therapy. Like we said, medication works for some, doesn't work for others. Writing, journaling, all of that. I mean, I'm always talking about yoga. Yoga helps me.
Nice.
Now, what if the guy struggles to express themselves, you know, typically need to take action to solve their problems? If they have struggled to express themselves, how do they don't get to do the talk therapy, what other advice would you have for them?
My go-to is always writing. And it's probably because that's where I found the greatest value when I was struggling. And I also try to encourage people to just be around animals, because that also works for me. My greatest therapists today have fur. There's something beautiful and magical about pets. And I think for me, because I struggled so much with love, loving self and loving others, that was one of the greatest gifts that they gave me. They just helped me to be calm. You know, they regulated the system. They gave me a break from some of that turmoil that was going on.
When you said you suffer from OCD as well, how do you manage that nowadays?
You know, that one isn't as consuming anymore. I think for me, I always try to think about what I can control and what I cannot control. And it's a simple visual exercise where I step back and I actually make a chart. Like on one side, I write down in my control, and on the other side, I write down out of my control, and I make a line and I write it all out. And then I rip that piece of paper down the middle. But it's effective because it allows me to think about how much time and energy I'm putting towards the things that I cannot control. And it just allows me to step back into my power, taking time to get grounded. Smudging. I was really fortunate to spend 8 years teaching at an Indigenous college, and that's where I was able to learn the power of culture. And that's something that really resonated for me. And the more that I was able to connect with myself, I found that a lot of my challenges with mental health dissipated.
Okay. So you did a combination of like spirituality, talk therapy, journaling, Reiki, any type of movement therapy?
Yeah, I'll try anything. I mean, I'll try anything. And like we said earlier, it's what works for one won't work for another. But open mind, having an open mind is key.
Having an open mind is key. What advice would you have for maybe a family member that has somebody and doesn't know how to talk to them, or might be seeing some of the signs, doesn't know how to approach it?
I think we overthink this one. It's as simple as approaching someone and saying, I don't mean to pry. I just want to let you know I'm concerned. I just want to let you know I'd be more than happy to listen if you ever need to talk. That is it. And I would say that is everything, because a statement like that says, I see you, and you have now given them an invitation to be heard. But whether or not they act on that invite is completely out of your control. I would just then encourage that person to repeatedly check in and make sure that they know that that door is open. And the key thing is this: that individual who you're concerned about probably won't want to talk right away. Like, it might take them 3 months, might take them six months, but when they do, the most important thing is that we, in a position of support, drop what we're doing, validate their courage, and just listen. That's it. Just listen. Like, how many times, I think everyone can relate to this, where you talk to someone that you trust. I mean, for 10 minutes, you just talk. The other person listens. And at the end of those 10 minutes, you sit back and you think,
that's all better.
Why? Because you got what was on the inside out. And that's the gift that we can give people. We don't have to be a formal counselor. We can create that space where they feel comfortable enough to just talk. And we literally have to just bite our lip. Elders always remind us we have two ears and one mouth for a reason.
It could be very scary to be on the other side, or you could be scared to ask what's really going on, because then you feel responsible that you would have to do something to help them. And I know for some people that's a struggle. I also think it's hard for people to be open about it and ask directly, like, are you having suicidal thoughts, right? Like we were talking about, that's such a heavy word, but it's literally what therapists do. Like, we just ask the questions and we get the answers, but some people are not asking the right questions. So they're not, they're afraid, right? Like I said, what happens if I ask my friend this and my friend says yes? What do I do now? So I think education is very important when it comes to men's mental health, suicidal ideation, having the talk, teachers learning how to recognize all these signs. I think it just comes down all the way down to education and talking about it.
Prime example of why I think we shouldn't shy away from conversations around mental health and suicide. I was meeting with a father, and he knew that his son was struggling with his mental health. But being a typical father, he had no idea how to approach that conversation with his son. And there was one night where he just approached his son and he said, "Hey, are you okay? What does the son do?"
"I'm fine. I'm good.
I'm fine. Yeah."
And so the dad leaves it a couple days later. He tries again, asks the same question, gets the same response. And the dad's thinking to himself, "There's no way. There's no way." So the dad decides to change up the way that he asked the question. The way that the dad then asks is he approaches his son and he says, "Do you think about killing yourself?" Which is a father, that as any parent, that's a tough question to ask. Now, how does the son respond? "Every single day, Dad." Because he asked a different question, he got a different response. And because he got that response, they had a very powerful and meaningful conversation about how his son was really doing. And the son was also at a place where he was willing to access some of the resources that were available in the community. And that, for me, is the best example of why we cannot shy away from what is often a very difficult and uncomfortable conversation.
Yes, that you're right. That's the perfect example, actually. And it happens every day. I've been a witness. What would be your last recommendation? Like I said, maybe on the other side, for those that are struggling with suicidal ideation, depression, any type of self-image distortion, or just going through mental health difficulty at this time.
I recall meeting with an elder who said, "It's okay, Al, to let the bird in your mind, but do not let it make a nest." I think that where we get into trouble is where we let all those destructive thoughts in and we ruminate on them and we start isolating and we start withdrawing. And that's where I, like many, get into trouble. I would encourage people to redefine what it means to be strong. Vulnerability equals strength. I would encourage those individuals to reach out to someone who they think they could trust. And if they're not there yet, then I would encourage them to grab a piece of paper and just write and see how they feel as they are free from some of those emotions. But, you know, the biggest thing is just hope, is trusting that one day you will not have to fight so hard. That was my saving grace. I hung on to that for so long because the only word I can use for me is hell. It was hell. And I always said, there has to be some reason, some purpose for all of this pain. And there has to come a time where it won't be this hard. And it's true. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to go through those uncomfortable feelings. Like, sometimes we just have to do things afraid.
Yeah. Sometimes I always say it's okay not to be okay. And the more we normalize that, the more vulnerable people are going to be able to become and just talk about what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love this conversation. I loved we touched a little bit upon the men's mental health. I mean, went all the way to the school system. It's probably my fault. but I love what you're doing. Please keep raising awareness, especially in the school and the youth. I think this is just an important work that you're doing, and I'm glad that you found your journey. I'm glad that you're using your past story to, you know, educate others and instilling hope on them.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for this platform and for the work that you're doing to strengthen these conversations.
I'm trying. No, thank you. Thank you so much for participating. Hopefully in the future, we can talk into other things. I'm thinking other things, like school systems. Yeah, no, we loved it. Thank you. I mean, do you feel there's anything we missed that we should talk about?
No, I think it...
Because we're good. I think we touched on anything, but if I miss something...
Yeah, no, I think it always goes where it needs to go. So thanks again for what you're doing. I appreciate it.
Thank you everyone for watching. Please let us know your thoughts and don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'll see you next week.